Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the only journalist to interview Edward Snowden since he surfaced in Hong Kong, Peter Maas, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, where he recently wrote an 8,000-word profile of Laura Poitras, how Laura Poitras helped Snowden spill his secrets. We will discuss how Peter Maas was able to get the interview and what he knows about who has custody of the thousands of top secrets Edward Snowden left the country with, a small portion of which have been made public. Then we'll examine the role of the reactionary Mubarak-era media in Egypt and the extent to which it is driving the polarization as Egypt descends into violence. Noha Radwan, a professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California, Davis, joins us to discuss how both the government and the independent TV channels have inflamed the deep divisions with frenzied descriptions of the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorists by the pro-military media, while the pro-Islamist media portrays the current regime as fascists. Then finally, we'll get a flavor of the Association for Unmanned Vehicles Systems International's trade show underway at the vast Washington Convention Center, where the 600 vendors are showing off the latest in drone technology, surveillance equipment, and high-tech sensors for both military and civilian use. Alexei Kosov, a multimedia journalist currently working for the Los Angeles Times' Washington Bureau, joins us to discuss his article in the Los Angeles Times with Brian Bennett, Drones Descend on Washington Just for Show, and the FAA's opening up of the nation's airspace in 2015 to an estimated 10,000 unmanned aircraft by 2020. And joining us is Peter Maas, who's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, who has reported from the Middle East, Asia, South America, and Africa. He has also written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The Washington Post, and Slate. And Peter Maas is the author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which chronicled the Bosnian War and won prizes from the Overseas Press Club and the Los Angeles Times. His latest book is Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And he profiled Laura Poitras, who photographed the only footage and interviews available of Edward Snowden in Hong Kong, and Laura Poitras served as an intermediary with Edward Snowden, enabling Peter Maas to do the only interview with him since he spoke on camera in Hong Kong. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Maas.
Good to be with you.
And you described in your New York Times Magazine piece profiling Laura Poitras how the whole Edward Snowden's statements, his leaks, if you will, were generated, and how, I guess, in a way, he sought Laura out first, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, he sought Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian columnist, first, but Glenn wasn't able to kind of open his encrypted channel of communication with Snowden, so Snowden then went to Laura Poitras. And because she had been working on a film about surveillance, because she had been under surveillance herself, she was living somewhat of an encrypted life and was very savvy with these things and was able to offer him a public encryption key and so they could begin to have encrypted, secure communications. And that's where things really got going.
And Laura, of course, had made this very, very, I thought, very, very poignant film about Iraq, where she talked to Iraqis about what was actually happening to their country. And apparently that put her on the no-watch, no-fly list, did it not? She was regularly searched every time she got on a plane.
Well, we don't know for sure what got her on the list. This is one of the strange things about these watch lists, no-fly lists, extra screening lists, is that the government doesn't tell people who are on these lists, first off, whether they're on them, and then once people become aware because they're getting stopped, the government doesn't tell them why they're on it. So you can't kind of, you know, there's been an accusation made against you or whatever. You don't know what it is, so you can't perhaps get yourself off the list because you don't belong there. And in the case of Laura, she's filed Freedom of Information requests, and she has tried to find out why she's on the list. She's asked every time that she's been stopped, why is this happening? And she's never told. So she doesn't know why she's on the list. What we do know is that these stops at airports began in the summer of 2006. And what I also found out is that there were investigators from the Department of Homeland Security's Joint Terrorism Task Force that interviewed soldiers who were in Baghdad at the time that Laura Poitras was there, who believed that she was filming an attack against them and had foreknowledge of it. This allegation which was investigated by the Department of Homeland Security. I don't know if this is the cause for her getting on the watch list. I looked into it. It has really, there's no evidence to it whatsoever. It just makes no sense whatsoever. But it is something that was looked into by the government. And whether this is the reason or one of the reasons that she got on the watch list, we don't know.
And Peter Musk, obviously Edward Snowden has become the story. It's really the message which he wants to get out to the world about what the U.S. government is doing in terms of surveilling American citizens. And even, of course, in response to what happened, the President of the United States called for a public debate, a national debate. That hasn't happened yet, although there was a very close vote in the House indicating a swing, I think, in public opinion. And then the Pew Research Center did do a poll indicating that just within a year, the American people have swung where they previously were in favor of more surveillance in the war on terror to a belief that the government has gone too far. So I think it's fair to say that the focus has been on the messenger and not on the message. But what's your understanding of why he chose to go essentially to end up in two countries that are ultimately sort of hostile, if not unfriendly, to the United States, China and Russia?
I did not talk to him about that, so I don't have any, you know, particular inside information about that. All that I can just observe about it is that there are very few countries that he or anyone in his position could go to with any degree of confidence that they would not be immediately extradited to the United States. So he had, I think, first off, limited choices of where to go. If he went to a nice democratic country like France or Germany or whatever, they would probably hand him over quite quickly to the United States. And then secondly, he did receive offers of asylum from several countries in South America, and he was apparently on his way there, but he got stopped in Moscow because he didn't have the full travel papers that he needed for onward travel. His passport had been revoked by the time he got there. And so actually, it depends on how one, you know, wants to interpret it, but, you know, my understanding of what happened is not so much that he chose to go to Russia for asylum, but that he got trapped in Russia. And then once there, he asked for asylum because there was nowhere else to go. The United States had forced down the aircraft carrying the Bolivian president when he was flying out of Moscow because they thought Snowden was on it. So this meant that Snowden, whatever flight he might take out of Moscow to go to one of the countries that offered him asylum, there was a reasonable chance that that flight would be forced down so that he could be extradited to the United States. So I think, therefore, the framing of it as, you know, Snowden chose to go to Russia or chose to seek asylum there is really not correct. The correct way of understanding it is that Snowden got trapped in Russia, and so that's where he had no other choice but to ask for asylum because he couldn't get out.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Musk, who's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, who has reported from the Middle East, Asia, South America, and Africa. He also is the author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which chronicled the Bosnian War and won prizes from the Overseas Press Club and the Los Angeles Times. And his latest book is Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And he recently did a profile of Laura Poitras for the New York Times Magazine. And Laura Poitras served as an intermediary with Edward Snowden, who Peter Musk was able to interview recently in the only, I guess, post-Hong Kong interview that he's done. And so tell me about how that was set up. It was an encrypted interview, was it not?
Yeah, well, basically, you know, without kind of getting too much into some of the details, but basically I was working on the story and Laura asked me, you know, this is over. We weren't together at that time. I went to Rio to talk with her and Glenn Greenwald, but this is after I wasn't in Rio at the time. We were not in the same place. And so we were communicating through an encrypted channel, and she said, would you like to ask some questions to Snowden? She had not asked him whether he would answer them, but she just said, I'm willing to submit to give him your questions. And I said, sure. So I sent her, again, through encrypted means, questions for Snowden, and she then transmitted them to him through, you know, probably much more highly encrypted means. And he decided to answer them, and he sent them back to her encrypted, and then they were sent back to me by Laura encrypted, and then had to hold on to it for a little while, and then finally we were able to publish the answers, and that's how they got to the public.
And they got to the public via the New York Times, who published the transcript of your interview with Edward J. Snowden. And his comments, Edward Snowden's comments, are not favorable to the New York Times, or for that matter, for what is often referred to as the mainstream media.
That's correct. The first question I asked him was, you know, why did you choose Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald as opposed to a reporter for the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal? And he immediately responded saying, you know, basically the mainstream media had discredited itself in the last decade by not challenging the United States government and had, not provided the information that it should have provided to American citizens, and that it was only reporters like Laura and Glenn who had, in his words, the courage to report, you know, fearlessly on surveillance and other matters that the U.S. government perhaps didn't want to be either reported on or reported on in the way that they did. And so that's why he chose to go to them. And that was the first question I asked, and that was his blunt answer. And, the answers, we published the transcript on the New York Times site, also published it on my website. These were questions that were submitted to him by me. I'm an independent writer. I was writing this story for the New York Times. But the New York Times has done a very good job of publishing this full transcript, as well as a story I wrote that's nearly 8,000 words long that goes into great detail on what happened.
So how did you, did you have a limited amount of questions you could ask? Did you have to do some triage yourself? Or, in other words, were there any ground rules to the interview?
No, there were no ground rules. You've got to understand that the offer was made by Laura to simply transmit my questions to Snowden. She didn't know whether he would answer them. He hadn't, as far as I know, asked her to get questions from me. So when I, drew up the list of questions, first off, there are no ground rules, but I was working on a story that was focused on Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald and how kind of they got this whole story. So I decided to just limit my questions to that issue, Snowden's interactions with Greenwald and Poitras, his reasons for going to them, and his reaction to them once he finally met them. So I just decided to limit it to that, to make it kind of simpler and easier. And I kept the number of questions relatively short, just about six questions or so, because with kind of sub-questions embedded in each, because I felt that if I asked a whole laundry list of questions, he might just kind of think, as anybody in that situation would, oh, my God, I don't have time for all this. So I kept it short and sweet.
But clearly, there are a lot of questions to ask, right?
There are a lot of questions to ask, and I was... pleasantly surprised that he decided to answer them, and B, he answered them very directly. It's easy particularly when you're given written questions and there's no follow-up, to avoid answering them or just to answer them in a way that, isn't necessarily very direct. But he took each question and he answered them very directly, very concisely. It was really useful.
And what do we know, or do you know, Peter Maas, about what exactly everybody has in this saga? Because there's been a lot of speculation that the Chinese intelligence got the four laptops, which I'm not sure exactly what the source for the fact that he supposedly had four laptops and a bunch of thumb drives, but that's been the assumption that's been in the press since the story began, and that the Russians also had access to it. Barton Gellman of the Washington Post was there in Hong Kong. It doesn't seem like the Washington Post has published too much. The UK Guardian seems to have taken the lead in publishing what they have so far. One of the things we heard from Glenn Greenwald was that there is an ability to drop a huge cache of information into the public, so presumably it exists. And I imagine it's driving the intelligence people crazy to know that all this stuff's out there, and I imagine they've done their own damage control to find out what they think has been taken. But what's your understanding of who has what, and also why the Post hasn't published anything, the UK Guardian has?
Well, let's see, one at a time here. The Washington Post story, they had a couple of stories based on documents from Snowden, but the writer who wrote those for the Washington Post, who you mentioned, Barton Gellman, did not go to Hong Kong.
No, I see.
Was not in Hong Kong. Was not part of that very crucial part. So I don't know how many documents he or the Washington Post might have, but as of now, they have just published a couple of stories based on what appears to be a very small number of documents. I know nothing more than that. In terms of what Snowden has, and I do not know myself, in terms of whether other entities, Chinese government, whatever, might have gotten a hold of whatever he had or has, I have absolutely no idea. So I can't speak to that. There is no sourcing that I'm aware of for the stories that mention that the Chinese got whatever was on his laptops. It seems to anybody who has said that or has said that the Russians have gotten material from him, not necessarily voluntarily, but hacked into his computers. There's no sourcing I've seen for that in the sense of, like, you know, they got this information from somebody in the Russian intelligence service or Chinese intelligence services. It seems to just be rank speculation. What I do know, and what has been stated publicly, is that Greenwald and Poitras are in possession of thousands of documents that was given to them, were given to them by Snowden. The exact number, I don't know. Different numbers have been floated out there, but it is thousands, of which they've only published so far a handful. And they told me that they have not shared these documents with any of the publications, the entire collection of documents with any of the publications that they have published with. They have published with The Guardian, mainly, but also Der Spiegel in Germany and Globo in Brazil, and I believe they are planning to publish with other publications as well. But they provide to those publications only the documents that are relevant to the stories they are publishing with those publications. The kind of, full files are under their control and have not been handed over, they told me, to any of the publications that they publish with.
And does that include WikiLeaks? They seem to have played a fairly important role, at least in terms of getting him the papers to get out of Hong Kong. And
It's not known. They certainly appear to have played a role, because somebody who was a volunteer for WikiLeaks was with Snowden, and Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks or co-founder of WikiLeaks, has tweeted about communicating and being involved in Snowden's journey from Hong Kong to Russia and his asylum application. But as far as WikiLeaks having documents, Snowden providing WikiLeaks with documents, or Greenwald and Poitras providing documents to WikiLeaks, I do not know of any of that, and I really can't say any more than that.
So I take it that Laura Poitras has the scoop of a lifetime in her film, that she's been making a film about the surveillance state, and this whole surveillance summer has been preoccupied with Edward Snowden, and all we've seen so far is what Laura has filmed. So do you have any sense of when this film will be completed? Not that Act 3 is over yet?
I really can't say. I mean, I do not know for sure. I don't know if Laura knows for sure. She is still working on it. And as you know, when you're working on a film or when you're working on a book, you never know really when you're going to get it all finished. And certainly the fact that the Snowden thing has just happened and it's still ongoing and represents, as you mentioned, the story of a lifetime, but also just more practically a huge amount of material to integrate into a film that was already well along. I don't know when this film is going to come out. She's working, all out on both continuing to publish some of these documents as well as working on her film.
And is she going to go with Bruce Fein and Lon Snowden, Edward's father, who are heading to Russia soon?
I really can't say.
Right. Well, I've spoken to Bruce about it, and I don't know whether you know Bruce Fein, but he's a very passionate defender of the Fourth Amendment, and he is, obviously a somebody that had an enormous amount of government experience, but is really an extraordinary voice in his concerns for how much the surveillance state has overtaken our constitutional rights. I just also spoke with Bill Arkin a couple of days ago, whose new book, American Coup, is a devastating expose of the extent to which our rights have dissipated and how we have a kind of alternative universe of the Constitution that we think we know about, the one that they teach us in school, and you hold your hand over your heart and salute the flag over, and then there's this other part that he calls the XYZ of the Constitution, arguing that a bunch of gray men, desk-bound men, agents of the national security state, are operating in an alternative universe that is almost unstoppable, because in the information age, there is no such thing as enough information. So, the enormous investments in the national security state and in this pursuit for more and more and better and better algorithms, according to Bill Arkin, is all but unstoppable. Did any of this dichotomy come up, if you will, even though it's essentially at the heart of the story of what Laura and Edward Snowden have done?
Well, I think it's, the question of whether it's unstoppable or not is what they're working on. That's, I think step one for Snowden, and this is just me kind of reading the tea leaves, is making it known what is being collected. And step two, which is not in his hands, is people reacting to it, and if they think it's too much in the way of data collection and surveillance, working through Congress or other means to make sure that this much data is not collected, that it's protected, that it remains private. So, it would certainly be unstoppable if nobody was aware of it and paying attention to it. But now that people are a bit more aware of it, it becomes, the potential for stopping it is greater, which doesn't mean it's likely, but the potential for at least slowing down the accumulating speed of it, and also for just making people aware of what is going on, that certainly is greater.
Well, Peter Maas, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Maas, who's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, who has reported from the Middle East, Asia, South America, and Africa. He's also written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The Washington Post, and Slate. And Peter Maas is the author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which chronicled the Bosnian War and won prizes from the Overseas Press Club and the Los Angeles Times. His latest book is Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And he just published a 8,000-word piece in the New York Times Magazine, How Laura Poitras Helped Snowden Spill His Secrets. And Laura Poitras served as an intermediary with Edward J. Snowden, who Peter Maas was able to interview. And that interview was published also recently in the New York Times. Thanks again, Peter.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the role of the reactionary media in Egypt stirring up the polarized and dangerous politics of that divided country.